This is KFUO and KFUO FM, Clayton in Greater St. Louis. The time is 5 p.m. We take you now to Seek Hall on the campus of Concordia Seminary for a special program in connection with the Luther Tower dedication.
This is Walter Grotrian speaking to you from Seek Hall on the campus of Concordia Seminary. There are many events going on the campus of the seminary this weekend surrounding the dedication of the Luther Tower. Luther Tower was originally planned when the complex of building comprising Concordia Seminary was erected in 1926, but due to lack of funds has not been completed until this time. Luther Tower is dedicated to the ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Among the events of this weekend is this particular one, which we will bring to you this afternoon as it originates in room 202 in Seek Hall on the campus of the seminary. This afternoon's program is one of ministry and community, and it will center on the community and its problems and the church's relationship and responsibility to the community problems. The panel this afternoon will feature the mayor of the city of St. Louis, the Honorable A.J. Cervantes, the supervisor of St. Louis County, the Honorable Lawrence K. Roos, who will speak on the community and its problems, and speaking on the church's relationship to these problems and the responsibility of the church, the Reverend Dr. Arthur Carl Peepcorn, member of the faculty at Concordia Seminary, and the Reverend Dr. David S. Schuller. Moderating the panel, the Reverend Professor Robert L. Conrad. We are gathered here in Seek Hall. There's a crowd of possibly 150 to 200 people that have gathered here to participate in this community program, representing many different denominations also interested in the ministry of the church in our time as it relates itself to the community and its problems. The actual dedication ceremonies of Luther Tower will be held tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock and will also be brought to you live by radio station KFUO. The speaker for the dedication ceremonies will be the Reverend Dr. Oswald C.J. Huffman, speaker on the International Lutheran Hour. Many dignitaries of the church will be gathered for this particular dedication ceremony. Participating will be also the Reverend Dr. Alfred O. Fearbringer, the president of Concordia Seminary, under whose direction this particular tower has been erected. Chairman of Public Relations for Concordia Seminary, an active man in the arrangements for these programs, has been the Reverend Professor Robert L. Grunow. Participating in tomorrow's program will also be the Concordia Cantata Chorus under the direction of Robert Bercht and bands from the two Lutheran high schools in the St. Louis area. The people of the community will also have the opportunity to hear a carillon, a traveling carillon, that will give a concert before the dedication. The concert on the carillon will begin at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and there will be another concert at 6 o'clock in the evening. Dr. Mariette, a renowned carillonier, will give these carillon concerts. This traveling carillon has been brought here to Concordia Seminary because it is anticipated that in the not-too-distant future there will be a carillon erected in the Luther Tower itself. The tower has been built to accommodate such a carillon. As we're waiting for this particular afternoon's event to start, I'd like to also announce this evening at 8:30 there will be another presentation. The first was last night, of Three Faces of Tomorrow in the Chapel Auditorium. These plays, three short one-act plays, are under the direction of the Reverend Professor Norman Hovell and Steve Wolf, who is a student at Concordia Seminary. Waiting for Godot is one of the plays that will be presented, as well as The Fallout, which was written by Norman Hovell. And the third play will complete three views of life, actually, in these productions of the Drama Society. That's Three Faces of Tomorrow, tonight at 8:30 in the Chapel Auditorium of Concordia Seminary. Tomorrow evening, and we'd like to stress this because it has been erroneously announced as for this evening, it's rather tomorrow evening that the Concordia Seminary Chorus, under the direction of Dr. William B. Heine, will be heard in its annual spring concert. This will be at 8 o'clock in the field house of Concordia Seminary, and the featured work on the seminary choruses program will be the Bach Cantata No. 4, Christla in Totus Bonden. The events will continue also on Monday, and Monday evening at 8:30 in the Chapel Auditorium, the Concordia Cantata Chorus in the direction of Robert Bercht will be heard in a presentation of a work by Jan Bender, a premier presentation of the St. Louis Cantata. And as I have heard it described, it must be an exciting musical composition written by Jan Bender for this particular occasion and designated as the St. Louis Cantata, about a 45-minute work. That will be at 8:30 p.m. Monday evening in the Chapel Auditorium of Concordia Seminary. If you tuned in late, I would like to tell you that we are broadcasting from Seek Hall at Concordia Seminary this afternoon's event in connection with the dedication of the Luther Tower. This afternoon's event is to be on ministry and community. It's a panel discussion on the community and its problems and the church's relationship and responsibility toward these problems. The speakers of this afternoon's panel will be the mayor of the city of St. Louis, the Honorable A.J. Cervantes, the supervisor of St. Louis County, the Honorable Lawrence K. Roos, and speaking on behalf of the church, talking about the church's relationship and responsibility to the community's problems, the Reverend Dr. Arthur Carl Peepcorn, the Reverend Dr. David S. Schuller, both of the seminary faculty, and also the moderator of the panel, another member of the faculty, the Reverend Professor Robert L. Conrad. I see now that all the participants have arrived. The mayor of the city of St. Louis is just taking his seat with the panel, and we hear now from the moderator, the Reverend Professor Robert L. Conrad.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the campus of Concordia Seminary and the weekend of the dedication of Luther Tower. We have our distinguished guests with us this afternoon, and after a word of welcome by the president of Concordia Seminary, they will present their parts of this community and ministry program. At this time, I'd like to ask Dr. Alfred Fearbringer, president of Concordia Seminary, to welcome you all to our campus. Mayor Cervantes, Commissioner Roos, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Conrad has pointed out that we have quite an extensive program in connection with this Luther Tower dedication. We tried not to overlook anything, and particularly not to overlook what might be the most obvious, but also the most easily expendable program, and that is to have something that relates us more closely to our community. And so I'm very happy that we are able to have this discussion this afternoon and the dinner later on, in which we and our community hope to get more closely acquainted with each other. St. Louis was a lusty town of about 75 years old when the founders of Concordia Seminary landed on the banks of the Mississippi in 1839. And they were very well received, very hospitably received, always enjoyed good relations with their community, both the civic community, the educational community, the cultural community, in fact, in every way. And since this gap of 75 years existed, when the city celebrated its bicentennial, we also operating in terms of quarter centuries, as we usually do, celebrated our 125th anniversary. So we ran some competition to the city in that respect, but we also rode on the coattails of the bicentennial celebration, and it helped our program very much. Of course, incidentally, we had a project like the Gateway Arch, and we also had a certain amount of rivalry there. When the steel started buckling on the arch, and I felt sure the tower would be dedicated before the arch would be finished. But when they corrected that, then I lost my confidence. But I'm very, especially then when the finally the last section was put into place, I thought, well, we lost the race. But I'm very happy that in this respect, St. Louis County has it over the city and that we're able to dedicate this tower before the arch is formally dedicated. I might mention this too, that we're definitely relating to St. Louis. You know that the arch is built with a catenary curve rising up from the ground. Our prospective new chapel is going to have the same curve, except that it will come down from the pinnacle of the chapel down to the ground. So we have this living reminder then of our relationship to the city and the county, and we hope that the discussion this afternoon will give us many more points of contact and will show how Concordia Seminary and its community can relate ever better to each other and can always be of greater service to each other. Thank you. We have asked the Honorable A.J. Cervantes, Mayor of the City of St. Louis, and the Honorable Lawrence K. Roos, Supervisor of St. Louis County, to be with us today to speak frankly to us about those problems, political, moral, ethical, of the respective areas which they represent. And in a sense, we structured this so that we become the community and the church listening to the community's leaders as to the way they see things, and then ask two men on our campus and its faculty to respond with the church's relationship and responsibility. After the presentations of these four men, we would like to have some time for questions from any of you that might be asked to any of the men who are here. So, if you have that in mind and have a question, jot a note and be prepared to ask it when the first part of the presentations are concluded. To begin our discussion, then, we call upon the Honorable A.J. Cervantes, Mayor of the City of St. Louis, to help us to see things as he sees them. Mayor Cervantes.
Reverend clergy, ladies and gentlemen, it's a extreme pleasure for me to have the opportunity today to talk about St. Louis and our problems and our ills, including the wrinkled arch, which fortunately was overcome, and it won't be too long before we will have the formal dedication, and we hope that this summer that people will be riding up and down in the capsules. But I have a prepared text today because the subject that we're about to speak about is highly important to the entire community. Our era has become to be known with such titles as the Century of Urban Man, the Age of the Cities, and the arithmetic is simple enough. In the last 50 years in the United States, the proportion of persons living in the cities has increased from 46% to 70%. Further, it must be grasped that this 70% is concentrated on but a little more than 1% of the land in the entire nation. 7 out of 10 Americans live in urban areas. That is 140 million people. By the end of the century, 4 out of 5 Americans will live in urban areas. That means there will be more than 285 million city dwellers. And that means that in the next 34 years, we must build as many homes, schools, stores, and other fixtures of urban life that we have built since the time that the Mayflower arrived. The growth of our cities is fantastic, but the explainable thing is simple enough. The so-called population explosion is the natural factor. But more importantly, however, is that we are in the midst of a climax of a worldwide revolution from the agricultural to the urbanizing the industrial society. The most telling spurt of urbanization, unfortunately, caught cities when most of them were becoming obsolete. There was a depression in 1930. There was a world war in the 40s. There was no adequate machinery at any level of government to meet the physical and social challenges that swept over the metropolitan centers. As a local sidelight, I would like to point out that in 1950, some 150,000 people left our city to live in the suburbs. At the same time, some 100,000 persons, mainly displaced from agricultural centers from the South, both white and Negro, came to St. Louis hoping to find that it was the promised land. But very frankly, due to many forces of change, it was not the promising land for them. At the very time, these people, many poorly educated and with only a few basic skills, were coming to St. Louis, economical and technological changes were wiping out the sort of jobs that they could do. I would say that most cities have risen quite well to the need for rebuilding themselves as physical plants. It is a matter of distress that our cities have not done well in meeting the social blight as they have in meeting the steel and concrete side of the problem. This has given rise to some rather pathetic paradoxes. We are in the most powerful and prosperous era of our national history, yet we have the biggest and worst slums of all of our years. Employment, production, and profits are all new time heights. The affluent society has become a catchphrase. Yet we have hundreds of thousands of our people, some estimates run up to 1/5 of the population, who live in poverty and form times or hopelessness in their way of life. Further, we have yet to find ways and means to prevent that poverty and hopelessness from becoming the sad heritage of the offsprings of 1/5 of our people. Our colleges and universities are sprawling from their old campuses to meet the new demands for higher education. Yet you know only too well that many of our children are virtually dropouts in the first and second grade. Many industries are nearly desperate in competition for skilled personnel. On the other side, hundreds of thousands are not only unemployed, but unemployable. Many of these cannot pass screening tests for even unskilled jobs. The United States, for all of its might and know-how, still falls short 30% every year in providing new housing needed by our moderate income families. Nationwide, there are some 4 million urban families living in homes that couldn't pass any decent set of housing standards. On the governmental side, note that this is the most successful democracy in world history. We have, however, failed so far to align the three levels of government, federal, state, and local. In fashion, incapable of dealing with this effectively and with the urban problems in dealing with them effectively. I do not wish to imply that our cities will collapse this summer, but it is quite true that our cities have had similar problems throughout the centuries. But we must face up to the fact that these needs are now of unprecedented vastness. The growing forces of technical, economic, and social change have never been as rapid nor on the scale of those in recent decades. And in some respects, they are still accelerating. Neither St. Louis nor any city in the nation can reach its promise until all in America make a total commitment to the task ahead, particularly the solution of social problems with all the moral aspects they entail. That commitment has yet been made by too few. But it has been by the leadership of our churches. This is one of the most sound reasons for being confident that we shall achieve the social and spiritual renewal of the cities. It would be an empty triumph to put towers towards the sun in part of the city and not in any other sector. and in the other sectors to leave slums with all their misery and evil. It would rather be like the story of the Tower of Babel all over again. You gentlemen follow the trends of religion and its activities in your workaday lives. But even as a mere observer, I feel no hesitation in saying that I believe general recognition is coming to the great change that has gone in the world of churches. The days of alienation between creeds are happily gone. Neither in America have we attained today's level of sophistication and maturity in the field of religion. Never before have our churches been such a liberal and dominant source for the social solidarity and progress. We have put aside the petty bickering that once so preoccupied too many of our church people. I think that more and more Americans have made a great decision to follow the original and so simple concept of all faiths, that all men are brothers. We must now bring that decision into fulfillment. There is such work to do, particularly as it applies to the changes in our cities. You are all too familiar with the pattern through which many of the older and stronger congregations migrated to the suburbs. It was a natural thing to do, and it so happens that I'm not saying this with any recrimination, but in moving from the city to the suburb, one may leave behind a house, but one cannot leave behind one's social and moral responsibilities. It is regrettable but true, for quite a span of years, many congregations deserted not only their houses of worship in the old neighborhoods, they tried to forget the need of those who had taken over their old homes, their old neighborhoods, and the very houses of worship themselves. But it is heartening to note that now there has come a strong wave of consciousness of spiritual and human needs of what has been labeled the inner city. This reaction came most fortunately at a time that the men of the world of business again took another acute note of the stake that they had in the old central sectors of the metropolitan areas. Businessmen found that many forces of change affecting the inner city threatened the dollar volumes of downtown. And simultaneously, there was a recognition of a human and spiritual value which were being neglected. So we have now the dual task of physical and social rebuilding of our cities. And I feel our progress warrants optimism for the future on both fronts. As proof of my observations of the new spirit of the churches for the social progress, I need but cite St. Louis's War on Poverty. Our program, as you know, has the most apt name of the Human Development Corporation. Working with it now are units, agencies, men and women of every one of our major denominations. They are working very well together, and in fact, I feel the spirit of solidarity is being accelerated by this experience. Much of our effort in St. Louis to achieve social renewal is among our Negro citizens. That the human needs are great is seen at a glance. That the efforts to bring them opportunity must match the need and should be seen just as easily. Name the need and it is there. Jobs, better housing, education, family security, and a chance to walk in dignity. St. Louis has done well in the field of human rights. Recognition of those rights and observances of them is progress. It is meaningless to acknowledge the right and not to provide the opportunity for its exercise. For example, we have a fair employment law. Much of the outright discrimination has been eliminated. Yet we know that unemployment rate among Negroes is twice as great as that of whites. Much of this is due to the lack of opportunities for jobs because of lack of education and work skills. The question of adequate employment is, to my mind, the most important aspect of urban Negro problems. So it is the prime concern of St. Louis to provide the training and placement machinery so that there will be a great opportunity To do this, we have joined with the federal and state governments in creating a full employment program. The heart of this program is that the field of workers will, for the first time, have a chance to work intensively with individuals for sufficient time to match them with a job. The Human Development Corporation is covering the whole range of human needs. Much of this is done through the neighborhood centers. Day after day, the HDC people are at the logical spot, the neighborhoods where help is most needed. In all of these efforts, I am most grateful that we have always had the generous and valuable aid of the clergy and congregational leaders. As a layman, I would not presume to say how the ministry should meet community needs, but it is my view on urban problems have given you any insight that will be of use to you. I feel greatly rewarded for having this opportunity to be with you today. And I thank you very much.
You have just heard a presentation by the Honorable A.J. Cervantes, Mayor of the City of St. Louis, at this convocation in connection with the dedication of the Lutheran Tower on the campus of Concordia Seminary.
Speak to us, the Honorable Lawrence K. Roos, Supervisor of St. Louis County, that place to which the mayor indicated a lot of other people have gone. So we will ask now Mr. Lawrence K. Roos to speak to us.
Thank you, President. Fearbringer, distinguished clergy, Mr. Mayor, and ladies and gentlemen. I, too, am extremely happy to be here and to join in these ceremonies of dedication of the Lutheran Tower. I think that Concordia Seminary, through the years, has represented one of our prized religious and educational assets in St. Louis County, and to be on this program is a privilege for me. I also feel that there is some significance in joining with the mayor of our important city of St. Louis in discussing the problems facing our respective communities. Like Mayor Cervantes, we have problems. Unlike the problems of the city, which I think are built and developed around problems of perhaps rebuilding, as the mayor has said, rehabilitation, sometimes re-education of people from different cultures and different types of social backgrounds. Our problem in St. Louis County derives more from one word, really, and that word is growth. Our county has grown like Topsy, and with this growth have developed many, many problems which don't necessarily associate themselves with poverty, which don't too often associate themselves with people perhaps who have moved from relatively limited, from areas of relatively limited educational and social possibilities and opportunities. Our problems arise from our ability to accept the dynamic potential that lies ahead of us in this growing community and making some semblance of sense out of what is developing from this growth into a rather chaotic and disorganized pattern. To give you some idea of what I mean by growth, we merely have to look back to what our county was a few years ago. If we go back to the year 1940, 26 years ago, we had a county which had a total population of approximately 250,000 people. It was a sparsely populated, essentially residential area where life was simple. Well, instead of 250,000 people, today in St. Louis County, we have 875,000 people. Instead of 80,000 automobiles which were registered in St. Louis County in 1940, today we have approximately 350,000 registered vehicles. Instead of peaceful country lanes, which were an aesthetic pleasure to those of us who had plenty of time and who weren't concerned in those days with traffic jams, today we have these enormous expressways. We don't have enough of them. We have these same peaceful lanes which have all of a sudden been called upon to bear a volume of traffic 5, 6, 7, in fact even 10 times as great as it was just a few years ago. Back in 2 decades ago, the principal economic activities of our county, our principal industries, consisted of a few corner grocery stores, an occasional drug store, a few filling stations. Those were the good old days. Today we have enormous industries. We have Monsanto's, we have McDonald's, we have Chrysler's, we have Emerson's, we have establishments that employ scores of thousands of people and who have activities extending way beyond the borders, not just of this metropolitan area, but of our nation generally. What I'm saying is that our community, in a very short time, has grown explosively, has trebled and quadrupled in its population and in its activity, and I think many of the problems that we face today arise from the fact that our officials of government, as well as most of the citizens of St. Louis County, were not conscious, were not aware of this change, and did very little to fashion the machinery of government and the machinery of society to deal with this tremendous growth. And if our only problem, if the only challenge facing our community were that of trying to digest the growth that has already occurred, this might be a more feasible and attainable objective. But if you think that the growth from 250,000 to 875,000 is shocking, and it is shocking to many of us, we're told that within the next 15 years, that by the year 1980, another 700,000 people, this is nearly as many people as today live in the city of St. Louis, an additional amount of people in this number are going to move into St. Louis County. So you have some idea as to the basis of the challenges and problems facing our county. Now, what does this growth mean in terms of governmental planning? Well, it means that we have two general categories of need. First of all, we have a very severe need for capital improvements, for physical facilities, schools, churches, roads, parks, public buildings, to serve this ever-growing population. Secondly, it means that we must fashion the machinery of government, the machinery of local government in St. Louis County, so that it can meet the service needs of our people. And I would like very briefly to just discuss with you how we might approach these two needs. What are these capital needs? Let's look at the road needs in St. Louis County, and I hope that after the mayor's extremely interesting and rather stimulating remarks that I'm not becoming too parochial and getting into matters of specific county problems, but these are of real interest to any of us who are going to live here. Our road network in St. Louis County, which some of you may feel was measurably improved last year through the passage of a $30 million bond issue, and I felt some satisfaction that we passed a bond issue at long last, Back in the year 1961, this is 5 years ago, a survey was made of our road needs in St. Louis County. Sverdrup and Parcel, an engineering firm, indicated 5 years ago that to bring the network of county roads up to an adequate standard for the needs of that time, that we should have $100 million of new roads. Well, we passed a $30 million bond issue. We know that the volume of traffic on our roads increases at about a 7 or 8% factor each year, so you have some idea of what our needs will be if we're going to be able to move people and move goods from one end of the county to the other in the years ahead. Our park acreage in St. Louis County today is approximately one-third the amount needed, according to national standards, to serve the leisure time requirements of our 875,000 citizens today. With this new influx, which we can see over the horizon, and with people having more time on their hands for recreation and leisure activities year after year, just think of what we'll need in terms of parks. And we have this ridiculous courthouse across the way in Clayton, a courthouse which is supposed to serve a modern community, which dates back to the year 1875, which is so inadequate, so small, that we must spend some $200,000 annually merely to rent outside space for offices that should be in our county administration building. This is a matter of efficiency, a matter of cost. You go a few blocks south of the courthouse to our juvenile facility and see a juvenile home that was built to satisfy a maximum capacity of 30 children, which today has an average capacity or an average use of 40 to 45 children, where children literally sleep on the floor frequently. And this is something that shouldn't exist in a county which is the richest and the fastest growing county in the state of Missouri. So we have very real needs for capital improvements of all sorts. Secondly, we have a very urgent, and I emphasize the word urgent, a very urgent need to improve the mechanism of local government, the structure of local government within St. Louis County, if we're going to be able to serve our citizens today or in the year ahead. Today we have 148 separate governmental entities within this one county of St. Louis. We have a county government, we have some 95 municipalities, we have over 20 school districts, we have a whole raft of fire districts, metropolitan sewer district, a bunch of special service districts. You have to be a Philadelphia lawyer, if you will, to understand where the responsibility of one governmental entity starts and where the other begins in St. Louis County. And if you can tell me that at a time when we're spending all sorts of brain power and money to get people from this earth up to the moon and to solve these very difficult scientific, humanitarian problems which we're facing this country, and we don't spend any effort at all to make the facility and the mechanism of these local governments work in an enlightened community such as ours, I say we're missing the boat in this respect, that we're going to have to solve this. I recommend, or we have recommended frequently, not the elimination of all of these municipalities. We've recommended, and as an ideal solution to the governmental structure of our county, fewer and larger municipalities. Municipalities which are large enough to provide local services efficiently, small enough to remain responsive to the wishes of their citizens, and these municipalities concentrating on local services with the county government in turn, spending its time and efforts concentrating on matters of area-wide concern and area-wide administration, such as public health, such as the backup services that all police departments need, such as the planning of the flow of traffic on our arterial highways, An ideal solution to local government in our county, as I see it, would be a partnership of our county government with fewer municipalities more able to provide local services. And our county charter, which dates back to 1950, needs revision. We have got to extend the merit system in St. Louis County. County government and city government today, I'm sure the mayor will agree, involve certain highly technical and professional skills. Activities such as data processing, as engineering of roads. Well, I defy any one of you to try to hire engineers, data processing experts, when you've got to tell them, look, you come to work for us, and if we happen to be reelected, possibly you'll have your job. This day of hiring people because they can punch a doorbell for the Republicans or the Democrats is, the day of doing business like this is over if we're going to have efficient government. And the extension of the merit system throughout all of our local governments, I think, is an essential element to improvement of our operating capability. Secondly, I think many of the appointed positions in government should be made elective to have administrative officers working within a government where you have a chief executive officer and yet the administrative officer is an independently elected guy responsible frequently to a to another loyalty, to another political party, also is unworkable. We have in our county government today a supervisor who's supposed to have responsibility for operating the government. We have a highway engineer, a recorder of deeds, a sheriff, and a whole gamut of people who are in effect department heads who could care less what the supervisor would like to have them do. It's very similar to imagining General Motors operating with Ford executives heading up the Chevrolet and Oldsmobile division. You can't do this. And this has got to be changed if our government of the county is going to be able to meet the needs of the future. There are two major targets that we have to deal with if we're going to achieve any of these changes. One is we are going to have to achieve a greater degree of cooperation from our state government, from our state legislature, to give us the necessary home rule authority in St. Louis County to refashion our government structures to meet our needs. I say that where we have 875,000 people living in our community, that those people should be permitted by majority vote to determine the type of government we want. Those people should be given the right to determine and guide their own destiny without our having to run up to Jefferson City, which is the source of all of our authority today, hat in hand, asking for little favors when we want to improve our operating structure in St. Louis County. We need help from the legislature, and more than this, and this is where I, as a government official, feel that the churches can be especially helpful, we need a more interested and alert citizenry. One of the biggest problems we have today is apathy. People couldn't care less about local government unless something is going on that they feel is detrimental to their interests. We had one of the biggest turnouts in history before our county council last Thursday when we wanted to locate an incinerator in some particular part of St. Louis County. Or if you want to improve a highway and it takes somebody's front yard or a part of his front yard, they'll come out and they'll shake their fists in your face. But if we want to have a public hearing for charter improvements, if we want to have something of a constructive nature, all too few people care. People unfortunately tend to respond to chaos. They don't react until something has broken down and a catastrophe has occurred. And here I would say to those of you in the clergy, those of you who are active in our educational effort, you can be a tremendous help to us in government if you will teach the importance of local government, if you will encourage people to take part in these local governments. I happen to feel that where government can be operated efficiently on a local level, it is better than an extension of federal and national government into our local communities. But I think that one of the reasons why national government has tended more and more to involve itself in our cities and our counties and our states, I think that the reason for this has frequently been a breakdown in local government, which has been caused by the apathetic attitude of so many of our people who close their eyes while our governments are poorly administered. So I say to you, you can be of enormous help to us by urging your people, your students, and your followers to take an interest in the type of people who make themselves available for these public offices, to take an interest in charter proposals, in bond issues, and in all the other activities of local government, so that we can make our local activities function and function efficiently, so the federal government is not going to have to look over our shoulders and come in to fill a void that we're incapable of filling. I think we can do this job if the churches and if our citizens will take an interest in it. The job can be done. If not, I think we're in for very real trouble. Thank you so much for letting me be here. Appreciate it.
You have just heard an address by the Honorable Lawrence K. Roos, Supervisor of St. Louis County, in this convocation on the ministry and community originating on the campus of Concordia Seminary.
Supervisor Roos, for putting the challenge pretty bluntly. I don't think we could have asked for more honesty than that.
This convocation on the ministry and community will continue on the reverse side of this tape.
We ask him to respond first, and then we will come to Dr. Schuller. Dr. Peepcorn.
Thank you, Mr. Conrad, President Fearbringer, Mayor Cervantes, Supervisor Roos, fathers, brethren, ladies and gentlemen. I think that I speak for the politically lay element of the congregation this afternoon if I stress the fact that we are profoundly grateful to have individuals heading up our city and our county whose awareness of the problems with which they and their respective communities are confronted is so detailed and so perceptive. It is, I think, worth noting that the individual whose name the tower that we are dedicating tomorrow bears in 1529 recast the ancient litany of the medieval church and introduced into it a section which was quite generally unknown apart from a few very general intercessions in the medieval litany. This particular set of additions is of, it seems to me, very great importance because of the circumstances which evoked the restoration of the litany to the prayer books of the Reformation movement. It was evoked by nothing else than a crisis which involved the entire culture of Western Christendom. In 1529, when the litany was restored, the Turk was besieging Vienna. He had moved up the Danube Valley and was at the very doors of the Holy Roman Empire. It is understandable that the litany should be restored to the worship of the church in order that by penitence and petition the mercy of Almighty God might be besought for the people of the Holy Roman Empire regardless of their immediate religious loyalties. The particular series of petitions that are introduced into the litany in 1529, at a time, I would remind you, when the very purpose for the restoration of the litany itself is an international crisis of the greatest moment begins with a petition to give to all nations peace and concord, to preserve our country from discord and contention, to give to our emperor perpetual victory over all his enemies, to direct and defend our prince and all in authority, and to bless and keep our town officials and our local communities. Unhappily, in the process of translation into English from the Latin of 1529, some of this fine sense of graduated responsibility that begins with the international community and ends up with the bailiff in the village and the people who are responsible for the leadership of the church in the village council got lost. And it didn't get lost only out of the litany. To a very large and distressing extent, it got lost from the awareness of Christian people. I should like to respond to the presentations that have been made, not in any sense trying to speak to the details that have been presented to us, but to talk to the theological basis which it seems to me must underlie any sort of responsible Christian entry into the affairs of the body politic. 444 years ago to the day, on the 21st of April, old style, 1522, which would make it the equivalent of the 30th of April, the doctor of the church, whose name the Luther Tower perpetuates, wrote a letter that may well serve as a parable for this afternoon. He addressed it to the court chaplain and privy counselor of the Saxon elector, the Reverend George Spalatin. It contains this paragraph: "There is also Matthias Buchbinder, whom I promised that I should intercede for him so that he might possibly become the bridge master at Wittenberg in the office and place of the now deceased incumbent. He is poor and in need. Nevertheless, if someone is more fitted, merit system, I do not want to urge him, but I shall try to help him in some other way. Do what you can and should." Now, this paragraph exhibits, first of all, an awareness of a human need, which at that time could have been multiplied, as it can be multiplied today, many hundredfold. It recognizes that a responsible task is an admirable way to social rehabilitation. It makes use of available political channels and social institutions to accomplish its purpose. It carefully avoids letting concern dictate favoritism that might result in another kind of unfairness. And it recognizes that a need constitutes a demand until the need has been met. Members of the church are social beings. God made them that way. While his ultimate ambition for them is that they may see him and enjoy him in the life of the world to come, and to anticipate some of that in the life of this world, he has in our time giving them increasingly greater longevity, during which they are to express their commitment to God in lives of earthly service. Members of the church, by definition and by their baptism, are members of the mystical body of a Christ whose concern was not only with the next world, but who showed a profound interest in the world that now is, the world that was made through him, the world that, to use St. Paul's phrase, hangs together in him. There, Lord, is one the account of whose earthly life contains report after report of compassionate intervention into the daily lives of ordinary people as he assuaged their hunger, healed their diseases, and restored their health of mind and of body. It has become transparently clear, particularly through the newer biblical theology, that he did these things not chiefly for their public relations value, or even as evidences of his supernatural power and origin, but in a very primary sense, he did them to demonstrate his implacable opposition to and his determination to destroy the demonic powers whose ubiquitous presence ubiquitous human suffering attests. The element of social concern has been a prominent feature of the church's history, sometimes more prominent than at other times, As Christians, sometimes in large numbers, sometimes only a few in a generation, served their fellow men for God's sake, for their fellow men's sake, and also for their own sake. To cite again the words of the doctor of the church, whose name the tower that we are going to dedicate tomorrow bears, taken this time from a prayer book that he composed in the same year in which he wrote the letter from which I have already cited, "We who are many are one loaf and one body, in that we all participate in one loaf," says St. Paul. "We eat the Lord through faith in the word that the soul takes to itself and feeds upon. In the same way, my neighbor eats me again. And I give him my possessions, my body, my life, and everything that I have, including my time and my concern, and let him feed on it and make use of it to the extent that he needs it. Again, I need my neighbor. I am poor and indigent, and I let him help and serve me. Thus we are woven into one another, so that we help one another as Christ has helped us. The sacrament should have such an effect on us that it makes us over into new people. For the words and the works of God do not want to be unused, but to accomplish great things, and that we fear nothing, but also that again we become the servants of the most insignificant people on earth, and not regarded as a burden, but rejoice that we are able to find someone who needs our help, and to tremble because we have so much that is good and do not share it." And although the words are not his verbatim, his is the spirit that inspired the affirmation of the Church of the Augsburg Confession on Civil Government, a part of which reads, "The gospel teaches an eternal righteousness of the heart, but it does not destroy government of the family. On the contrary, the gospel demands their preservation as ordinances of God, and it demands the exercise of love in these ordinances. Therefore, Christians are necessarily bound to obey their officials and laws, except when commanded to sin, for then they ought to obey God rather than men." This passage from the Augsburg Confession describes the gospel as a force that, in addition to its saving virtues in terms of the world to come, preserves and stabilizes the very conditions for decent human life in the present world. It declares that civil government is of God, but by that token, it hails every concrete form of human government before divine judgment. It denies Christians at any time the luxury of cheerful acquiescence in the status quo ante or the status quo nunc. And it reflects a profound awareness of the demonic forces that are loose in the world and that infect and distort every human expression of the divine ordinance of government. It demands that we exercise in every domestic, social, political, and economic context in which we find ourselves the forgiveness that we have experienced at the hand of a God who in Christ was reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them. It bids Christians live in the awareness that at any time they may be called upon to stand up in protest or to sit down in disobedience. Whenever any agency in any of the power structures of which the Christian is a part requires him to do what God has forbidden or to refrain from doing what God has commanded, the Christian, committed as he is to obedience, has now no choice but to disobey. He will do it without dramatics and without self-pity, without heroics and without histrionics. And he will do it with a full willingness to accept the consequences of what is a constant occupational hazard of Christian existence. He will do it whether the power structure is an agency of government, one of the school districts that Supervisor Roos talked about, or the federal government at the top, whether it is the parent-teacher association of which his wife is the secretary, or the manufacturer's association to which his firm belongs, or the labor union through and within which he must negotiate the circumstances of his employment. In our American democracy, the responsibility of the Christian citizen is constitutionally expanded beyond that of the 16th century political man. For us, the achievement of a more just society is not simply the task of the prince or the province of the city council. It is not only Supervisor Roos's business and Mayor Cervantes and that of the immediate cabinets and legislatures of a kind over which they preside and by which they are assisted and sometimes frustrated, but the mission according to his opportunity and occupation of every citizen. This imposes on him the use of all the avenues of influence in a democratic society, not only of the ballot, but also of the various channels of persuasion and correction that the availability of media of mass communication have made increasingly potent in our time. The empirical institutional church has, of course, the obligation of exemplifying the social justice that she sets forth as ideal, as far as this can be achieved in her own practice and in her own internal institutions. And she must avoid claiming privileged status in order to be exempted from the claims of justice that she upholds to others. She and her members must, as a matter of pragmatic necessity, since in none of her parts does she often control either the machinery of production and distribution or the agencies of service and of social ministry in her own right. And she must do so in an awareness that the achievement of the welfare of all is the common task of all. She must cooperate fully with every other public and private agency, governmental and voluntary, with which she can work together. By her own experimentation and by the contribution that she makes through her members to the agencies both of service and of government in the community, she has the opportunity and the obligation of creatively devising new ways to achieve the old and elusive ideal. And in so doing, she will be fulfilling her own petition, that men may be enabled so to pass through things temporal, that neither the environment, nor their education, nor their lack of health, nor their poverty, nor their unemployment or underemployment will place them in peril in the process of losing the things eternal.
Reverend Dr. Arthur Carl Pietkorn, speaking in a historical perspective and the church's relationship and responsibility to community problems.
Thank you,
in his convocation on ministry
we
and community
turn to
from Concordia
the last
Seminary.
Member of the discussion panel, Reverend Dr. David S. Schuller, whom we asked to be a part of this because for the past couple of years he has been on leave from our campus, going from city to city trying to alert universities and ecclesiastical and political communities to not only needs but ways to get at these. And so we thought this would be one way in which he could share some of those things with us. Dr. Schuller.
There's a certain advantage in being in the cleanup spot. First of all, the entire audience is beginning to see the light at the other end of this thing, which makes them, you know, a little happier about the whole situation. And secondly, the thought is in any cleanup man that somebody along the line should have gotten on base, and now you're trying to bring them in. Now, this has actually shifted on our guests. We've now had three men who have hit home runs, so I feel rather relaxed. They're already in, so if we don't, you know, get the score above 3-0, it won't be too bad. I find as I look abroad today that perhaps we might capsule a great deal of the spirit of this day in one expression, a thrust toward honesty. And I'd like to begin at this point. All of you who are working with young people recognize that there's a certain disenchantment today with the establishment. You recognize that we no longer feel that somehow a change of party or face in the city hall is going to really produce a tremendous change in the long run. We find throughout a concern with this type of change. Now, as we look at this student generation, I think occasionally we find that they're simply tilting with windmills. We say it's too bad. But at the same time, I think we find they're facing genuinely significant issues. If you would agree then that there's a type of thrust toward honesty, I'd like to raise a number of questions in behalf of the church that would really open, we hope, the next step in what we're talking about as a dialogue. May I go on just a little bit with this thought? I find a number of people are highly skeptical today when they find a man who a short time ago would have fought to the death certain programs because he was the spokesman for the liberals in this country, now defending these particular programs. We find a lot of people who are beginning to ask, can we move beyond the stage where we all say kind things about the church, but rather ask at what point, honestly, do we want the involvement of the church in the life of our world? Perhaps one other word by way of background. And that is, we discover so many of the traditional models are no longer operative. I think both of our first two speakers indicated this. To be even more specific, the traditional methods of police protection, for example, of welfare services are not able to cope with the type of urban revolution that Mayor Cervantes described. At the very time when we're trying to update a whole educational program, we find that we're at the same time trying to reach a group in the minority that we have not adequately reached before. To put this as bluntly as we can, throughout the history of the world, we find that the city historically developed in order to provide order and service and efficiency to society. But now we've reached the point where it's being seriously threatened by disorder, by inefficiency, and incapacity. One last word in the introduction, and that is to suggest that at the present time we've come to the day where secularism, as so many of you well know, has come into its own. And so a number of us are bewildered on the one side by a high religiosity, and yet by the fact that many analysts are saying we're dealing with a group of people who are not concerned with religion at all, where one sociological study after the other indicates that fewer and fewer people are looking to religion, to its rules, to its rituals, to its norms, for morality and for genuine meaning in life. And as you know, these studies are indicating that for some, religion provides a special interest or hobby. If you don't like golf, this is a possibility. For others, a new or renewed ethnic or racial identification is once again here. For others, it's the music, the ceremony, the architectural form that provides an aesthetic delight. Now, if you're dialoguing, and this means, you know, half of you are saying, I sure disagree, and I can hardly wait to get up and ask a question, can we now take a couple of steps? Number one, I would like to suggest that the church is involved in these very issues that our brethren were describing because of the basic affirmation of the church. And I would suggest that this is a pretty real problem for every one of us, because there are so many who are concerned to pick up, you know, everything from the latest issue of the Reader's Digest to the latest morning paper. And there's always the concern, why is the church meddling? Why don't you get back into the sanctuary where historically you have belonged? Now, the first point then is that we are involved in these very areas, not because somehow we have lost trust in what God is doing in the world and we're looking for another avenue of work, but we're saying because of the basic affirmations that we know as Christians. May I spell a couple of these out? At the heart of the basic mission of the church is an awareness that God has sent the church as his agent into the world. And we have to confess that the church denies part of its very existence when it becomes a closed corporation bent upon self-perpetuation. For we have received the mission that our Lord stated in the words, as the Father has sent me, even so send I you. And so as a group, as individuals, we are sent into this very world that we've been describing. At least one church body in the room has, within the last year, tried to remind itself of some of the implications of this mission. And we've said, you recall, that it's to the whole man, it's to the whole church, it's to the whole society. Spin for yourself, if you will, the implications of this. We are saying to anyone, then, who looks at the task of the church, we are no longer dividing, as perhaps we gave the impression at one time, a man into a physical part and a spiritual part, and saying somehow we are trying to serve the spiritual, but we see a human being as God has made him as one total entity. And so if you insist upon the division of physical and spiritual, the church insists today that it is sent to deal with the whole of man. And we need not be embarrassed as moderns by the very earthiness of the scriptures. It follows then, does it not, that where a man lives and how he lives and how he earns his living and how he receives medical treatment, where his children play and go to school, the quality of their teachers, the way that he is treated as a citizen and as a human being, all then become part of the vital concern of the church. We are then only attempting to reflect the same concern that we saw in our Lord, a concern that Dr. Peepcorn has already described. As he addressed himself to the physical, the social, the economic, the political concerns of men, One who then, as our Lord, spends his time healing the sick and feeding the hungry and condemning the artificial criteria by which social outcasts are produced. And in his talking about himself as Lord, asserting his lordship over the entire world. We won't spell out the rest of these, but will you, in your own thinking now, fill in the paragraphs on the church's mission to the whole of society? And this means then that we have to speak judgment as well as provide support, because we're saying that while God has given the social structures to our world, not any specific ones, as has been indicated demonically, we can always turn these to our own use. And it is then in this sort of confession that we say that part of the task of the church must be addressed to itself, that we too can forget, we too can begin to have the mentality of the colonial, you know, the building of empires, the extending of our great walls, our numbers, our wealth, and forget that we are sent as a servant people in order to do something else. Secondly, and here perhaps we hit the heart of our concern, the church is concerned and involved in the problems of community as both an institution as well as a group of people. Wouldn't you agree that this is the troublesome point today? Because there are a large number of people in our city who say, indeed, the church is to be involved, but, they go on to say, the church is to deal with individual citizens, give them insight, nourish them, and these individuals now in turn are to go into the thousand positions that you find in any given area. They add a major disclaimer that the church as church is ever to be involved. I'd like to have you examine this one. In contrast, some of us would rather suggest that the church must be operating on both fronts. First of all, she will indeed be present in these thousand places we were talking about as Christians consciously interpret their roles in life as they see God at work through them in the various parts of society. And from this point of view, we should not be complaining that the church is not adequately witnessing in some of these areas, because we're saying at the same time theologically, the church is already there through everyone who bears the name and the sign of our Lord. So that ideally, we have to say the church is present in the various departments of all 94 of those city halls, in the executive suites of the utility companies in this particular area, on the assembly line of the Chevy plant, in a dozen lush new offices in Clayton, in Igo Pruitt, in the St. Louis Police Force. And we're saying that to the extent that there are Christians there who consciously see their job and calling in terms of the faith, this is going on. However, we said honesty is one of our key words today. One of the great difficulties is the fact that the Christian is the first to admit that while it's relatively easy to see the implication of the faith as he disciplines his kids, while it's relatively easy to see the implication of the faith as you deal with your neighbor, it becomes very, very difficult to apply this same faith when you're dealing on another echelon of concern. For here, these men are caught in the pinch of conflicting loyalties as they operate on yet another level. So that we simply begin to say to one another, but that's the way the world of business or of government is. The aphorisms learned at mother's knee and in Sunday school somehow don't apply for one of our brethren who sits now at the head of a bank with $160 million that they have to deal with. I'm afraid very few of our congregations are doing an adequate amount, you know, to train the man as he makes this type of public decision. Now, this overly simplified analysis is suggesting, I hope, why the church must also operate as a group. Individually, we are bound to a particular sector of society. Many of us may feel strongly about the contamination of the atmosphere in this nation and also in this community, about the war in Vietnam, about the problems of world hunger, about the implementation of social rights for all people in the areas of employment and housing, but we are caught in a particular sector of society, and it's only as we work with a group that we're able to do anything in these areas. I feel there's been a fantastic change from the period of the feudal age. Third and last, what are the implications of this? What's the posture of a church, to use one of the okay words of today, as you spell out the implication of this? And here I would welcome a very critical reaction. It seems to me that the church is in a unique position to deal with the factor of change as we see it at the present time. Change, wouldn't you agree, is always uncomfortable. Familiar paths are less demanding. And while a small degree of change adds zest to life, when that change is too vast and too rapid, the person feels caught off balance and therefore becomes anxious within the center of his being. And yet one of the major characteristics of our emerging world, people keep reminding us, is the fact that we will be living in a condition of perpetual change. And so we have this sense of ambivalence. On the one side, we look forward with expectation to what may be coming technologically, but at the same time, there is fear as we see personal freedoms threatened and as we realize that now total annihilation is possible for all of us. Do you see, then, a particular and unique position of the church as symbol of both continuity and change? In the midst of very rapid change, a peculiar anchor in relating us to a God who remains and remains in charge. But for any who dare make a god of the status quo, she speaks of the transitory quality of all of life. A further implication is that this honesty suggests no more tokenism. May I be very blunt? I think in the past, the clergy often gave the impression of being dutifully grateful for the crumbs that were tossed from the table of the various power structures. Men were asked to pronounce invocations at certain ceremonial occasions. But am I being too critical when we suggest many of these were occasions when, frankly, nobody wanted either the judgment or the grace of God spoken? We simply wanted the status quo with the general blessing of God upon it. Perhaps at one time the clergy in their respective churches gave the feeling of being very grateful for this fleeting moment of glory. But another generation of clergy and of people is arising. And this is the group that's saying, if you want us only at the point where the decision is made, then no thanks. If you want us only to be channels through which you will now pour programs that have already been decided in other settings, once again, no thanks. But if you honestly want us to sit down with you, because we are also concerned about what's going on in this community, then, where the decision is being hammered out, perhaps there something might be done. We do this, may I add again, not because the church is seeking some sort of new position of power, but only because it desires to be faithful to a Lord who tells us that he remains in charge and that his word is speaking also to our day. Not only when we gather for cultic observation behind sanctuary walls. What does this mean? It means that the privileged position of the past we're willing to give up and to relinquish. We no longer want simply the tipping of the hat, the honor, and the deference. Some of us would rather be cussed out because you really understand what we're saying over against having everyone stand by very politely and frankly not caring what the church is saying because it is so hopelessly irrelevant. This means, may we say one last time, that we within the church must make sure that we continue to root out the vestiges of the colonial mentality. We are still a pilgrim people sent by God on a particular mission, and that every symbol of settling down behind the walls must be rooted out. May I share with you a couple of sentences spoken by a Dutch theologian now in our country. He says it so beautifully. If anyone asks where the church is, then we ought to be able to answer, there where people are emptying themselves, making themselves as nothing. There where people serve not just a little, but in the total service which has been imitated from the Messiah servant and in which the cross comes into view. And there where solidarity with the fellow man is not merely preached, but is actually demonstrated. And last, this means then that the church will be there in its people with both criticism and support. Again, honesty Many groups woo the churches. Many of you have attended meetings, for example, in which the labor unions invite the clergy. The general approach is, for example, we have very similar concerns. We need your support for some of our programs. Other groups do it a little less subtly, but it's nevertheless the same. So what we're suggesting in all humility, but in all realism and honesty, when you ask us to work with you, aren't you asking us to get down into the pit with you? We're requesting no privileged position, but rather the reverse. Where a particular policy can be supported, this we will do. But where we feel a particular view is short-sighted, then criticism will come. To be more specific, we understand that at the present time, a commission of the Lutheran Council of Churches has recognized that one of the major factors in the defeat of the bond issue for urban renewal some time ago was a group of property owners in South St. Louis, a large number of whom are Lutheran. And this commission said, the faith speaks to this sort of issue, and therefore it is up to us to acquaint one another with the implication of this. And as a result, we're going to find a rather heavy interpretation of the whole picture presented in the light of being a Lutheran Christian in this community. But as we could have illustrations in a half dozen other cities across the country, there are other points in which the church is going to be forced to say that, frankly, a program is selfish, short-sighted, obeys the letter of the law, not really its spirit, and therefore cannot be supported. This is saying, then, that we are asking to be part of this dialogue. And we mean this very seriously. Traffic is one of the major problems, we said. I don't think there's any unique Christian insight which is going to be of any particular help here. It would be the heart of pride and of foolishness to imply that because the church feels called to the public sphere, that therefore it has expertise. Not expertise, other than in this one area of being able to speak to this area to which God has spoken both judgment and grace. And now we are asking realistically for that possibility of sitting down as one of the dozen around the table to speak to this particular area.
The final speaker in this convocation on ministry and community at Concordia Seminary was the Reverend Dr. David S. Schuller. Other speakers included the Reverend Dr. Arthur Carl Peekhorn, the other clergyman, who spoke on the church's relationship and responsibility to community problems. Speaking for the community and naming its problems were the Honorable A.J. Cervantes, Mayor of the City of St. Louis, and the Honorable Lawrence K. Roos, Supervisor of St. Louis County. The moderator of this panel was the Reverend Professor Robert L. Conrad. This convocation was a part of the program of this weekend at Concordia Seminary in connection with the dedication of Luther Tower. The actual dedication of the tower tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. The public is invited. The speaker will be the Reverend Dr. Oswald Huffman of St. Louis, International Lutheran Hour speaker. This program at 4 o'clock will also be broadcast by radio station KFUO. This is Walter Grotrin returning you now to our studios.